Welcome to Streaming Thoughts, where we stream our thoughts on movies, TV, and all things nerdy. I am Daniel.
And I am Nathan.
And welcome to our podcast. So Nathan, what is on the news docket this week?
Man, did you hear that the African Prince of Zamunda is planning to come back to America?
I did not hear that.
Man, it's been decades since he's been to America.
A very long time. Yes.
Obviously, I'm talking about the Eddie Murphy comedy Coming to America, which is getting a sequel, but a straight to Amazon Prime sequel.
Interesting. I've actually been in a little bit of an Amazon Prime kick lately, so it'll be interesting to see what this sequel is going to be all about.
Oh, yeah? What have you been watching on Amazon Prime?
I've been watching a couple things. I've been watching Truth Seekers with Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, and I've been watching this other one called Wayne with a bunch of unknown actors and few people that are recognizable. But
you need to catch up on The Expanse.
I know you keep telling me to do that, and I have to do that.
I love The Expanse, but caveat, I do have my complaints about it. However, it is officially going to end its run with the sixth season.
That's not bad. That's a good amount of seasons.
Yeah, it's a good run, and it's nice that they announced that they're coming to a finale rather than just being canceled like a certain other streaming platform just keeps doing.
Right. One that remained nameless, but its primary colors are black and red.
And we've complained about it before. 3 seasons on the Sci-Fi Network and 3 seasons on Amazon is not too bad. Short of it being picked up by another platform for an additional seasons, I think we're doing pretty good.
Right. No, I always like it when shows are very intentional about when they want to wrap up their stories, right? I mean, it's usually something that doesn't happen, especially, you know, in the 5-6 season place or area, where a lot of shows, when they get to that 5th or 6th season, there's usually a, you know, we're gonna go the supernatural route or we're just gonna go the Expanse route.
I do like when they have a plan for going out, and I'm hoping that they can give a nice satisfactory end to this whole series, because it's one of the hardest sci-fis that we have out there, especially in some parts of the earlier seasons. It's really nice to get a good feel of space travel that looks and feels real in the sense of the actual physics of how space works.
Yeah, for sure. Because a lot of sci-fi shows that center around space travel have a difficult time conveying the realism of space travel, right? I mean, there are very few movies that do that as well. So it's really good to see it when it's well represented on screen, where you don't have to go too sci-fi in order for you to enjoy or appreciate what space travel really is about.
Here's a name you probably recognize from Casino Royale, Rogue One, Doctor Strange, Mads Mikkelsen. What do you think of him?
Yes, I know what you're going to say, and I like Mads Mikkelsen. He's a really good actor.
Yeah, and he is coming up to replace Johnny Depp in Fantastic Beasts 3.
Yeah, that's right. He is. I heard about those rumors earlier this week, and I guess they're confirmed. That's a really interesting transition from actors, right? I know a lot of people online are actually very excited about it, just because of Mads Mikkelsen being this really talented actor with a lot of really good range who can really play a really good villain when he needs to, right? And so I'm excited for it.
He kind of has a little bit of a challenge ahead of him in the sense of replacing a recognizable actor such as Johnny Depp.
Right. I agree with you on that.
Yeah, and when all that is said and done, they're going to have a little bit more of a challenge of capturing the look and feel of Johnny Depp's portrayal for Grindelwald, just because it's a more clean and open appearance. Whilst with Dumbledore, you just needed an older guy with a big white beard and eccentric wizard clothes, you have Dumbledore.
Right.
Grindelwald has been portrayed as a lot more cleaner, a lot more apparent bone structure, facial features, the way Johnny Depp just carries any character he's ever been given.
Yeah.
I understand why Johnny Depp has been sidelined out of the show, but I think Mads has a big shoes to fill in order to make it a seamless trilogy.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I have no doubts, obviously, that the casting director has made a good choice. I mean, again, Mads Mikkelsen is a very good actor with a lot of range. And so I don't have any reservations about his talents and what he's going to bring into this character. Obviously, it was a different transition, right, from going with the original actor Dumbledore, as you were talking earlier, to Michael Gambon, who, you know, had a very different feel to the character. But overall, people just accepted it, right? And people just kind of move past it. Move forward. And I feel like that's just going to be the same thing here. And again, I'm excited for it. I'm really looking forward to seeing what Mads Mikkelsen is going to bring to this role. I mean, it sucks for Johnny Depp, though. I mean, it sucks to lose a role like that. But, you know, ultimately, I feel like the casting choice for Mads Mikkelsen was the right one.
Yeah, and franchises need to do what's best for the franchise. And it is not without its controversy. I do ultimately think Mads is a good choice.
Right, definitely.
And the director of Sonic the Hedgehog is taking on a new project.
Ooh, which one's that?
An adaptation of the Pink Panther cartoon.
So we're going back to that again. So we already tried that once with, what was that actor's name?
Well, I kind of want to touch on that a little bit because I remember watching the Pink Panther cartoon as a kid and then seeing the Pink Panther movie. At the time, the original Pink Panther movie was pretty old. I'm not even sure if it was 1963. I'm not even sure if it's related to the cartoon or the cartoon was related to that. But they did make a couple of them in the early 2000s with Steve Martin in the lead.
Yes, that's who I was thinking about.
And the weirdest thing is I remember watching these movies and I remember watching the cartoon. But for the life of me, I cannot tell you anything about the show, movies or cartoon, about what it was about. It had like zero impact on my pop culture reference and knowledges because I'm just like, they were a thing that was there to watch between the other things that you wanted to watch.
I remember seeing the trailer for Pink Panther and I remember seeing bits of it, you know, when it was playing on TV, but I can honestly not tell you what that movie's about.
Yeah, and that was a callback to any young viewers of our audience. We used to have to watch shows on TV, and if you missed it during its normal airtime, you just missed it.
Yep.
You couldn't go back and restream it, or TiVo it or anything. No, we were stuck.
Yeah.
So there was times when there's a show you really wanted to watch, and then something like Pink Panther that you just watched because you didn't want to change the channel, and then another show you wanted to watch. And that's basically where Pink Panther has always fallen in for me.
Mm-hmm.
I know I watched it a lot. Can't tell you anything about it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the same for me. I honestly have no idea. And so I think it's so interesting what this director is going to do with this property that's been done quite a few times, you know, and reimagined in different ways quite a few times. And obviously, this is going more back to its roots, right, of being a cartoon or an animated series. So I'm very curious to see what they're going to do and who the voices are going to be. Is it a movie or is it a TV series?
It's a little bit early in the production. Because of his surprising success with Sonic the Hedgehog after the terrible 2019 marketing campaign.
Yeah, it was bad.
A lot of people are generally suspecting this is going to be a live-action world with a animated Pink Panther.
Okay, yeah.
So, I mean, time will tell as production continues the real direction they are going to take it, but that's where people are speculating just based on the success with Sonic.
Mm-hmm. I feel like this director has done a really good job at reimagining this character. Right? Obviously, the direction of Sonic, I felt, was very well done. And so I'm curious to see what he's going to do with this property again that's existed for a long time and that hasn't been touched since, I think, the last Pink Panther movie was released, I think it was in 2009. That was the sequel, right, to the 2006 movie.
Yeah, there is a 1963 Pink Panther, then the Pink Panther Returns or Strikes Back or something like that in the 70s. And then the property basically stagnated until Steve Martin took on the role in 2006 and 2009.
Yep, exactly. So again, I'm very curious to see what they're going to do with this new version of Pink Panther.
Although I can tell you there is one property that, whilst it is old and aging, definitely does not need a reboot because it has aged both wonderfully and terribly.
Oh, yeah. If we're talking about Die Hard, then I will completely agree with you on that. And that is the topic of today. Continuing our Christmas movies, we are talking about Die Hard, and we're talking about the original Die Hard that was released in 1988. That is the year I was born.
Wow. Yeah, the original Die Hard, continuing on our theme of is it or is it not a Christmas movie, you go back and rewatch this and it's like, wow, there is so many things of like, we actually did that? How did we survive? I think there's a reference to a pregnant woman wanting to drink at the holiday party. And they're like, oh, yeah, alcohol won't hurt that baby. She's like, are you kidding? This baby is ready to tend bar. I'm like, wow, that's That's not good.
No. There's a lot of the stuff back from back then that was like, yeah, it's very questionable. Would not fly today. And so those parts of this movie have definitely, you know, not aged well, right?
But other parts of this are really a great lesson for filmmakers today because they handled foreshadowing so well in this movie.
Oh, extremely well.
I mean, think about the setup that they did with him being without shoes. They use a setup of him being afraid to fly with another pastor giving him this really weird advice on how to get grounded after flying, which he does, and leads to him not having shoes. And then there is the scene where the lobby gets blown up and the captain of the police is complaining about glass all over his men. He's like, who cares about glass?
Right.
All for the setup of them shooting out all the glass in this office space, and he has to walk across the floor barefoot across all this broken glass.
Right.
That's brilliant.
It is so well done. I feel like, again, as I mentioned with every action film that we have talked about in this podcast, pacing for action films is everything. You really need to establish a good pacing and then the foreshadowing that goes along with that, and then how that pacing and that momentum of that foreshadowing keeps moving forward from scene to scene, and then eventually gets to that final payoff, like you're talking about with the glass, and then that bathroom scene, which was also, by the way, a very good scene. That kind of stretched more the acting muscles for Bruce Willis, because that was a really emotional scene that he delivered in that bathroom, right? As he was picking all of the glass shards from his feet.
And it was so organic. And I like how you bring up the fact that this is an action movie and the pacing of it, because one of the best parts about how this movie was set up is while it is an action movie, John McClane isn't your stereotypical action hero.
Right.
He's not rushing out and trying to immediately become Rambo or cowboy, even though there's a couple references that, again, foreshadowing that he's going to have to step up to those roles. The entire time he's there, he's not trying to engage them. He's not trying to go out and be a super action star to take down the terrorists.
Right. Guns blazing.
He's trying to get police to come in. He's trying to get the FBI, the SWAT team, he's trying to get the actual authorities who should be handling this in to be handling it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, he's trying to get help. And that was such a different take from other action films that were happening in that time, right? Especially after, you know, we had First Blood. I think First Blood came out in 1986, if I'm not mistaken. And so that kind of created a template, this lone badass that can do anything, right? And it kind of even continues on with today, right? I mean, you see movies like John Wick, for example, which, again, referencing John Wick again in this podcast, kind of a tradition, which is kind of ties into that, right? Of this lone...
The lone wolf, yeah. Think about the Taken movies.
Yes.
You have that lone badass who's just trying to be a normal family man until his daughter gets taken. Suddenly he's the one who has to step up and fulfill that male power fantasy of, I can do anything to protect and save my family, and I'm going to just rush out and get it done.
Yeah, exactly. And this movie was not like that at all. I mean, his first thought was not, okay, I'm going to like take on all of these guys. His first thought was, as you mentioned, is get help. Call the police, call anyone. Even when he was on the radio or the phone talking to the 911 dispatch, he was all like, I don't care. Just come arrest me. It doesn't matter. Just get help. Just bring people here, you know? And that was so great.
Right? It's like, if you don't get off this line, I'm going to have to report you to the FCC. Perfect. Report me. Come arrest me for breaking your rules. Just get someone here.
Exactly. And I thought that was really funny. One of the things actually that's really interesting is that Bruce Willis actually looked at this role from a funny side because, you know, this is supposed to be an all-American hero that is supposed to go up against German terrorists, when in actuality, Bruce Willis is more German than any of the people, you know, playing Germans, because Alan Rickman is British. And the other actors that were there, some of them were Russian, you know, but Bruce Willis, he was born in Germany. So so it's just really funny that we're talking about this all-American hero played by Bruce Willis who's going off against German terrorists.
What did you think of Alan Rickman trying to pull off the American dialect?
That was so interesting. Did you know, by the way, that scene wasn't rehearsed?
I believe it. That was like...
That meeting between McClane and Gruber, that was not rehearsed. That whole was like completely off script, and it was just... really interesting to hear Rickman's American dialect. I think that was my first Alan Rickman film, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, and so it was really interesting. I thought that he did a good job. I think that he could have worked on it a little bit more, but I think it was passable. It was good.
The thing that gets me, other than the circumstances, I don't think it was really made entirely clear as to why John McCain came to realize that this guy probably was one of the terrorists to give him the empty gun. But part of me wonders if it was on purpose or not. After that initial encounter, and he's trying to having this just general conversation, Alan Rickman was failing at maintaining that American dialect and would occasionally slip back into his normal way of talking. And I'm always like, was that just a slip of the actor, or was that purposeful to give the reason for John McCain not trusting this guy?
Yeah, because McClane was looking, if I recall correctly, through the names of the other people that were in the building, right? I think Gruber said, my name is Bill Clay, right? That was kind of his tell, I feel like, is when John McClane was going through all of the names and he did find a Bill Clay, but not in the place that Gruber had mentioned. And so I think that was the giveaway. But even before then, though, I feel like I can't remember exactly when he handed the gun to Gruber.
It was right after the name directory thing.
Okay, yeah. So then there you go. So then that was probably how he was able to tell.
Just kind of felt like that's what kind of confirmed it for him, is it was the name of a person in the building, but where he worked or where he should have been didn't line up. But he was definitely suspicious already at that point.
Right, because why would anyone be up there? Exactly. Now, what did you think? Because I feel like there's another character in this movie that oftentimes does not get spoken about. And I feel like it's a character, and that is Nakatomi Plaza.
The building itself.
Yeah, aka 20th Century Fox's headquarters, because it actually was 20th Century Fox's headquarters at the time. So what did you think of this movie being set in a building? And then the entirety of the movie takes place in one location, in the building.
I actually wanted to look into this a little bit. Is this one of the first times you have that trope of someone accesses remote parts of a building by climbing through the air vent?
I think so. I want to say yes.
I was trying to figure out and find any examples of that trope before this, but I think this might have been where it all started. And it just was like, oh, well, that's brilliant. We'll sneak it through the vents for Mission Impossible or whatever else. And it's one of those things like it works because you hadn't seen it before, but now that everyone's doing it, everyone is vividly aware of the idea of it. And you go into any building, you look around and you're like, yeah, no, the air vents wouldn't be big enough to allow a person to squeeze through.
No, they are absolutely not. I think that it's so interesting that the movie took place in such a small area, right? Because typically films like to, especially action films that are big blockbuster action films, usually don't take place in one building in one location, right? They usually want to make it as big as you can. And I feel like there's a sort of intimacy to this action film because of its being set in just one small area.
See, and that's one of the things that I think make the movie so successful, is by having him functionally trapped within the building with these terrorists, it creates that claustrophobic sense, that sense of imminent doom anytime he is anywhere. There's plenty of room to find safe haven for a brief period of time if he needs to get glass out of his cut up feet. But at the same time, he knows he can't stay there because these people are actively looking for him, and he needs to keep moving as well. And the combination of office space, parts that are under construction, decorative lobbies with plants and fountains to impress business associates who would come in to do deals. It all ties together rather nicely to create a large, expansive backdrop that you can have multiple events happening at different places and different times,
mm-hmm.
but still keep everything confined and have that sense of being trapped.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think that another thing that really helped this movie, right, was the incredible attention to detail to the set pieces. Because that's a nice thing, right? When you don't have to account for too many areas for you to film, you can go much more detailed when you have a limited number of rooms that you're going to be shooting at. I mean, most of the rooms where most of the film was shot were just maybe three or four. The office where Hans was sitting at, the main area where the party was happening, and then a couple of construction areas. But for the most part, a lot of the shots were shot in those areas. And I think that the attention to detail that went to that set design was also is what made it, what kind of took it and elevated this movie into another plane. And I feel like this is what makes this movie age so well. When filmmakers put this much effort into a movie and give it this attention to detail is what makes this movie, again, age really well. That's why Lord of the Rings, for example, is going to age so much better than The Hobbit will, is because of that attention to details, because they built these sets for real, because they did everything you see in the background. It's not a green screen. It's an actual
location. Yeah, absolutely.
So I feel like with these movies, again, just making sure that you go that extra mile and give it that extra realism is what gives it that this is going to age well factor.
Now, jumping back to some of our supporting actors, what'd you think of Mr. Master Negotiator, who can negotiate million-dollar deals? The one who reveals John McClane's real identity to Hans Gruber.
You are talking about Hart Bochner, who plays Ellis. Man, what a character, you know? And I actually went further into his IMDb page just to see what else this has been in. And his acting has been, you know,
sporadic,
a little sparse, you know, not a whole lot. I feel like his character was one of those generic, we need to set an example with somebody needs to die, right? And then this is the character that we're going to go with. And so I feel like his performance, though, on playing that character was really great, because you really believe that this guy was a sleazebag who was just the worst. He had no concept of helping others. He was just more looking out for himself.
See, and that was something I thought was interesting is he was portrayed as such a sleazebag who only cares about himself. When he goes to start making this deal and tells Hans Gruber that he can get John to come out and reveal himself and surrender and everything, you think he's going to be a sleazebag and use John's wife as leverage. And then he surprises you by not doing that.
Yeah, that's right. He did keep that.
He makes up this whole fake story about being longtime friends with John.
Right.
Instead of doing that. And so it's like, well, maybe he wasn't such a bad guy after all.
No, right. I mean, I'm not saying he deserved to die, but obviously he was written with that in mind, right? And by the way, fun fact, that line, Hans, Bubby, was completely ad-libbed. So if you look at Alan Rickman's reaction when Ellis goes, Hans, Bubby, you know, because it sounds like Buddy, but it's actually Bubby. And so Alan Rickman's look like, what? What did you just say? They kept that completely in the movie, but it was not even scripted. So that was great. That was a good line. But I totally agree with you. I think that this character, as far as performance is concerned, that guy nailed it. I mean, but I feel like they could have, I don't know, maybe they could have written it in a different way where the character could have survived, for example. I thought that could have been interesting.
Well, no, I mean, I think it was important to have him die, but it's interesting how they make him a sleazeball, like he's set up to die. And then before he actually dies, you get the sense of, well, maybe he's not such a bad guy anyway. He doesn't deserve to die. Oh, no, he dies anyway. That was some really good writing, in my opinion.
Yes. No, you're right. From a writing perspective, that was really great, because what, you know, one of the things that is a good lesson, again, as you mentioned, for Hollywood and for other filmmakers is that you'd never want to make a character completely unlikable, right? That you always have to give it a certain level of humanity to that character in order for you to feel bad. And also in order for the weight of the actions of the bad guy to carry weight. Because if this guy was a complete dick and didn't care about anybody, then Hans shooting him in the head would have been like good riddance, right? But it wasn't that. It was more of a shock. It was more like, oh no, he's serious. He actually is going to kill people here. And so that, again, is what gives it weight. And that writing and giving that dimension to that character is what makes that whole impact of him being killed carry more weight in the film.
Another supporting character that I thought was really well written, and again, I want your thoughts on this, because I thought he was really well written in the fact that he kept everything very serious, but at the same time still managed to give a comedic relief to tension, to keep the movie on a certain pace and a certain feel. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No, tell me.
I am talking about Sergeant Al Powell, played by Reginald Val Johnson.
Yes, Family Matters. He became a cop after this. He moved to another town in Family Matters because of his experiences in Die Hard, so that, at least that's my headcanon. When I think of Family Matters, I think, Sergeant Al Powell changed his name and moved to a different town because he couldn't cope with the with everything that happened with him in Die Hard.
It's one of those things. He's so well known for being in Family Matters that sometimes I forget he was a cop in Family Matters after Die Hard, not before.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that's why to me it's like, no, he completely moved and changed and everything. One of the things I do want to point out with this, the chemistry between Al Powell and John McClane was really freaking good, even though they were not present in the same room until the very end of the film, where they actually managed, where they actually got a chance to meet each other. But up until that moment, all the communication between McClane and Powell were done through radio. But that connection, that chemistry between the two of them was just so well done in film. And it's so rare for you to see a real connection between two characters that are not even like on screen at the same time, right? And so I think that was probably my favorite part about Powell. And you're right, the comedic elements that he brought into the movie were great. I mean, he was so snarky with Robinson, you know, his superior officer and all that stuff. It's like that combative aspect of him and that challenging of the establishment of the leader, right, was how he fought against that was just funny and exactly what the movie needed, right, in terms of like we're going to send these guys out there, and then this guy's like, your guys are going to get killed, trust me, and then like, we're going to do it anyway, and then like, well, I guess you guys are dead now.
Although I have to mess with your headcanon that he changed his name to Carl and moved after the events of this one, because he does come back and play Sergeant Al Powell again.
Wait, he does? When?
In the TV show Chuck.
What?
He plays a Sergeant Al Powell in the TV show Chuck for one episode.
I did not know that. That is awesome.
Do they like backdoor Chuck into the Die Hard universe?
Right? Oh my God. Yeah, no, that is, I had no idea. I literally had no idea. That is awesome though. This, by the way, was one of those movies kind of gave Bruce Willis this big recognition, right? I mean, after this, Bruce Willis's name kind of exploded, even though he had done, you know, a few things in the past and a few things in the years prior. You know, this is what really took him out there.
This was his American blockbuster moment. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Now, what do you think about this in relation to the rest of the cast? I mean, obviously, the other person who did well was obviously Alan Rickman. But when you look at everybody else, right, it's just interesting to see that the success is not as big. So what did you think about that?
That's really not all that out of place. Especially in these kind of blockbuster movies where either is a breakout or a obscure moment for the main character. Either the movie is so successful that everybody wants to piggyback off that success by bringing in the main character again for their action film, while the supporting characters are just kind of forgotten. It always seems to be a thing with Hollywood that they never really give the recognition to the success of this film to the supporting characters. A good example of that is DeVore White, who played Argyle. I thought he was great. I mean, he never had a major connection to the overall plot for the majority of the film, but the cutaways to him were very important at setting the mood and the pace, you know, again, breaking some of the dramatic tension with a little bit of comedy. Without him, the movie would have suffered. But honestly, I can't really think of anything else he's been in. He's not an actor that ever really popped out to me after this.
Right. And I think that's just interesting. I think that also speaks to the times when these movies were coming out, right? Because I feel like nowadays it's a little bit easier for actors to get a little bit more recognition when it comes to films because if they're more accessible, so to speak, right? Nowadays with actors having Instagram accounts or Twitter accounts and all of that stuff where if you wanted to see more or follow these people, you can do that. Whereas back then, obviously, Hollywood was a different time, right? It was a different Hollywood from how it is today. And so I feel like today, you know, when I see people playing small roles in certain movies, they eventually end up making their way into other things that appear, you know, and again, just because of the fact that there is Netflix and Amazon and Hulu Hulu and other big entertainment industries that are producing things besides Hollywood. And I think that had Die Hard been made in this age where there's other streaming services, I feel like most of these actors would have found other roles in other series a lot more easily than it was back then.
Yeah, and just an example of how little recognition he got for his role in this. He was only in like half a dozen movies since 1988 and hasn't really been in anything for almost a decade, leading up till he is in Die Hard commercials with Bruce Willis for the Die Hard batteries. I didn't even recognize him as Argyle because he's just been that obscure all this time. It's just like, oh, I don't understand the joke of his driver being this guy. What's this about? Oh, that was the limo driver from the first one. Okay, I guess that's funny if he was more recognizable, if he had springboarded this and people had realized that he had a good comedic element to be adding to your movies. It's kind of a shame.
It is, absolutely. Now, I have a question for you. This movie originally was supposed to take place over a period of 3 days, but it was changed so that it only took place over one night. What do you think about that change?
I think that was a smart change because ultimately, I don't really think you could have carried the believability of this movie over the course of 3 days, because no matter how much adrenaline you have going through you, you can't stay awake for that long. So at some point there would have had to have been watches with the terrorists trying to keep an eye over the hostages and trying to find John McClane. John McClane needing to find a safe place to sleep. And then you have all this question of believability over whether or not the police would allow this standoff to draw out for that long. Moving it into just a single night of, this is our plan, we are going to get all this money, we're going to fake our own deaths, and by the time everything's sorted out, we'll be off into retirement on a beach in the Bahamas. That's a much more concise and well-suited line of events.
No, absolutely. And I feel like when you describe all of that, when you speak about that, to me, what comes to mind is scale. Scale for this movie is just right. And that's, again, another lesson for action films, right? And a lesson, by the way, that going back to John Wick, that movie got right, is you don't want to make this a crazy Avenger-style film, in the sense that taking this place in one night makes it more believable, and it makes the scale a lot smaller, which makes the stakes a lot higher. When you have that, it's what gives this movie a lot of weight, right? And that's why Logan, for example, it's the same thing. The stakes are high because it's a small-scale story. From a practical standpoint of this being more believable, it makes sense. I mean, if I had a group of thieves and I'm going to hit a bank or hit this building and get all this money, then yeah, I mean, I'm not going to hang around for 3 days trying to do this. Are you kidding me? That also gives the authorities plenty of time to come up with strategies on how to deal with the situation. So a lot of these jobs have to be done quick and efficiently and get in and get out, right? You know, you don't want to hang around for too long. And so you're right. I think that it works better when it's a one-night thing. Although I feel like if this movie had been done with a three-day timeline or time frame, I think that the studio would have had no choice but to call on J.J. Abrams to make it work.
Oh, he's terrible with timing. So Hans Gruber's plan, he breaks in, takes everyone hostage, expecting them to treat this like a terrorist attack because of his past connections, even though he's been disavowed from that organization. Break all the seals on the vault until the FBI gets involved to cut power to this building in order to deactivate the magnetic lock so they can finally get in and get all of these Verabonds and millions of dollars. Then, when the helicopter was going to arrive with them taking all the hostages to this roof, they're going to blow the roof, faking their own death, and then getting away to safety.
Right.
One part of that plan still kind of confuses me.
Which one's that?
After they blew up the roof, how are they going to get out of the building with the millions of dollars past the police that were completely surrounding the building and all the exits?
Yeah, from what I understood about their plan is that they were going to use the ambulance. I think they were going to dress up as paramedics and they were just going to leave with the ambulance because nobody would look twice at an ambulance.
I don't know. I guess I didn't really see any foreshadowing on that one. Maybe I just missed it. But
I mean, that was kind of a...
That was always the one part of the plan that didn't make sense to me. It's like, okay, I'm with you all the way up to this point. Now, how do you leave? How do you get out of there?
Exactly. No, exactly. And I feel like that was one of the aspects that it took me a while. And because I've seen this movie so many times that eventually I figured out, oh, that we're going to use the ambulance, right? Because the ambulance made a very quick appearance. And that was with Argyle, right? When he, you know, basically used his limousine to run into the ambulance and knocking out that tech guy, right? And so, but that was it. That was like the only time when the ambulance showed up. Other than that, there was nothing. And so you kind of had to connect the dots as far as their escape plan because it was never fully explained. And so, yeah. All right, Nathan. With all that said, should we jump into our TLDL?
Too long, didn't listen.
All right. And this is a section where we give you our closing thoughts on the movie or TV series that we're talking about. So Nathan, Die Hard, 1988, year I was born, TLDL.
In terms of writing, action, foreshadowing, this movie is aged very well and can be used as a template to learn how to make great movies and has been used by multiple other ones. I mean, we didn't even get in about some of the movies that have obviously been influenced by this, and it's very clear why they were. Now, some of the cultural aspects from the 80s did not age so well, but
no,
that's inevitable for any movie of this, of any age, really.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree with you on this. This is a fantastic action film. It's got everything that you need in an action film. We didn't even get to the practical effects. The practical effects in this movie were also phenomenal. Again, just the pacing plus the scale of this movie is what gives this movie the weight that it carries and why it has aged well. On top of the fact that, you know, the set designs and everything about this movie has also been so filled with detail that this world is a believable place. And these characters are believable characters, right? Again, as we talked about with John McClane not wanting to go guns blazing against the bad guys. His first thought was like, I need to get help.
Exactly.
And that is believable. This is what makes this such a great action film. And so I always recommend it. If people haven't seen Die Hard, it's like, you haven't, you have to watch it.
Now, Dan, one final bit of foreshadowing we did not actually touch on. When John McClane first gets into the taxi with Argyle, Argyle turns on the radio and John McClane's like, can't you play some Christmas music? And Argyle's like, this is Christmas music. And if you listen, it's a rap song that is a Christmas song.
Yeah.
Is that not foreshadowing for the discussions and arguments people have about this movie? Is this a Christmas movie or is it not a Christmas movie?
Look, for me personally, this is the Christmas movie. I play this movie every Christmas in my house. It doesn't have to be watched, but it is always in the background. So for me, this is 100% a Christmas movie. But hey, if you disagree with me, or if you agree whether this is a Christmas film or not, you can definitely let us know on Facebook at
Streaming Thoughts and on Twitter at
Streaming Geek.
This has been Nathan.
And this has been Daniel.
Thank you for listening.